Oh, Lou. It's a sad song. Lou Reed, I think that's off Berlin.
Yeah.
It's off Berlin. You're listening to Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. It is another blistering hot day in Vancouver. It's about 10 past 2. 10 past 2 already. My first guest we're about to start out with is Dave Lapp, and we're going to be talking for the next over half an hour, and then after that I'll be playing an interview with Brian Sendelbach that I did last week, who is known for the comic strip Smell of Steve. Dave, how you doing?
Doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. Your book, Drop In, but Vancouverites may also know you for the strip Children of the Atom.
Yeah.
Which was in the Georgia Strait for quite a while?
About 5 years, from about 1998 to around 2003, something like that. But by my count, 5 years.
That's a while. That's a good run.
Oh, I think for an alternate weekly strip in Canada, it's like an eternity. 5 years. I think they didn't realize how long it was running. And then somebody went, oops, oh, 5 years. How did he, you know, how'd that get past us? So...
It's very different from Drop-In. I was looking at it. It's very, very different.
Well, the Children of the Atom is kind of me processing a lot of the problems that I was dealing with at that art center and dealing with it more metaphorically. Children of the Atom was before Drop-In, so I wasn't doing the life stories about the kids in the Drop-In center. I was just processing it through Franklin Boy and Jim Jam Girl. And then when they canceled the strip, it was just the sort of tandem where I was just starting to write stories about the actual kids instead of making it metaphorical. And that was the transition. They canceled Children of the Atom. And then I started doing these things called window mini comics, where the stories were largely about the kids in the drop-in centers.
So tell me about the transition in style.
Because
it's the first stuff's very, I was kind of describing to Colin, kind of looked like very Mark Bayer influenced.
And yep, totally stuff. Mark Bayer influenced. When I was drawing that, I mean, I had never seen anything like... The two big influences were Mark Bayer with Amy and Jordan in terms of opening my eyes to comics, and Chester Brown with Ed the Happy Clown. And just looking at that, two totally contrasting styles said to me, you're allowed to do that in comics. And that was a real eye-opener. I stopped buying superhero comics, and I wasn't really aware of the new alternate comics. I kind of knew about Zap and stuff. But seeing these active artists producing that kind of artwork was just, I couldn't believe it. It was really, you're allowed to do that? It doesn't have to be superheroes. It doesn't have to be Robert Crumb or S. Clay Wilson, you know.
There can only be one, S. Clay Wilson.
Oh, and you were asking about the transition and styles.
Yeah.
And what happened was, I'd been doing Children of the Atom for a long time, again, around 5 years. And when they canceled it, I suddenly realized, oh, crap, now what am I going to do? And I knew my life drawing skills had kind of atrophied, because Franklin Boy and Jim Jam Girl are more graphic or abstract. And I started sketching from life. I started writing stories from life, drawing from life, sketching people on the subways, drawing trees in Queen's Park. I just started doing that because, well, that was the next phase. And that slowly worked itself into these window mini comics and then later on into the drop-in book. So I had to learn to become sort of naturalistic again.
So maybe tell us about the drop-in center specifically.
The actual place of the book?
Let's start with the place.
Okay. I considered the place, when I was first working there, it was like a frontier. I had never worked with kids before, and when you come out of art school and you're looking for work, you know, you try to do this illustration or you try to get this paying job. And I saw at OCAD a poster on the wall for volunteer position in Regent Park. And I also didn't know Toronto that well, and I didn't realize that Regent Park was, you know, poverty and a place that people would say, ooh, Regent Park, you work there like a bad place. I didn't realize that. So I ventured out to see what it was like, and it didn't look so bad. I mean, going there in the daytime didn't seem so bad, and going into the actual art center didn't seem so bad. But when I started to work there, the problems with the kids and the discipline problems, and then, back then there was, swearing and racism and homophobia, and, there's a lot of problems because the place was in a transition from one person who'd been there for a long time to a new person, and it's just hard to explain. I'd never experienced anything like it. The most pointed example is once we established, a kid does something sort of naughty, they get a couple of warnings and they get a timeout. And I remember sending this one little girl up the stairs. Okay, she's about 9 years old, blondish brown hair, freckle face, big eyes. And I'm sending her out up the stairs, and she turns around and says, "Cunt!" And I just, I'd work with kids, and I just was like, I'd never heard an adult ever utter that word come out of the mouth of this kid. And I mean, it just stopped me. It froze me. It's impossible to express the inability to process being called a cunt by a little girl. And then yet you get more and more of that. It started to set the stage for we've got to take some steps around here to help these kids to do better, and help the staff to deal with being called words and all those other phobias or whatever. Anyway, that was a shocker, and that was that's within the first couple of months of working there.
Where are you originally from?
London, Ontario, which is so, conservative and WASPy, and I think sometimes when you live in an environment like that, you just don't really think about it particularly. But when you come to Toronto, you certainly notice the difference, the different cultures, the busyness and whatever, and I just never realized that London was quite as conservative and,
So, Children of Adam was that your first try at comics?
No. My first go at comics was when I was in art school. I developed this character called The Hood, and The Hood was very influenced by Charles Burns. I mean, Raw had a huge influence in me, the Charles Burns and Mark Bayer. And I did this comic called The Hood, and at the time there was a publisher called Vortex.
Mm-hmm.
And Vortex was the one that published Chester Brown's first work. And what happened was, while I was still in art school, when I was in first year art school, they had a comic art award from Vortex named after a fellow named Klaus Schoenfeld, who was a talented artist but died very young. I don't know how old he was when he died, but he sounds like he was just in his 20s, just getting started. So they named and he had done work for Vortex, with another guy named Ty Templeton, who mm-hmm. went on to...
Still does comics.
Yeah. And so anyway, they named an award after Klaus Schoenfeld. I was in first year art school. I won the award. I felt pretty special. I ended up developing a character, again, called The Hood. And I started doing mini comics with it. And quite unknown to Vortex, one of their editors went to the Beguiling comic store, picked up The Hood comic, and decided to sign me up because Chester Brown was leaving Vortex. And the publisher who had met me through the awards, the Klaus Schoenfeld Award, was like, oh, like same guy, like the penny dropped for him. Anyway, so the idea was I was to do a series for them, and we were going to call it Food, and I was to do The Hood and a few other stories, kind of like, 8 Ball or Hate or something, where you have, a couple of stories mm-hmm. Very different from each other, but in a running series. And then to shorten this story a bit, promise, we're going to print it. And it never happened, and then the company went bankrupt, and, that was that. So I have a full finished story called The Hood, a 60-page story, which pretty well nobody's ever seen. Yeah, done.
Which no one probably will see at this point, or?
I don't know. I look at it, and I think the people who read that mini comic way back when have found me at launches or other things that I do, comic rail events, and said, I really like The Hood. That was a great comic. And, that's from 93 or something, and they still remember it, and it's just a mini comic. So I'm thinking, geez, maybe it's worth printing up. But it's such old work to me that I don't know. It just seems a little difficult to relate to, I suppose. But, you know, what the hell, 60 pages, finished artwork, it's pretty easy to print it up. But it's so totally different from my other stuff. But anyway, so there's the answer. That's before Chilled in the Atom, it was The Hood, and then Chilled in the Atom, and then the Window Mini Comics, which turned into Drop-In.
The Children of the Atom, was that in any other papers in the Georgia Strait?
Yeah, it was in one called Perimeter in Winnipeg. And for a little while in one in Washington, I think Washington, D.C., which seems odd to have an alternate paper, called The Spark. And that one I don't really know what happened to Spark, but I know Perimeter went under, and Spark, I don't know whatever happened to it, except I would submit cartoons to them, and you just never hear back, so I don't know what happened with that one. So those were the main three that it was in, yeah.
And the Georgia Strait's still running.
And the Georgia Strait, yeah, the Georgia Strait's still going. I don't know what their cartoons are like now, but, I never knew, because it was in Vancouver. It was always odd sending Chilled in the Atom out to Vancouver and having no link with the audience, except for letters, I suppose.
They wouldn't send you a copy?
Well, they did at first, and then they said that it was costing too much, so then I had to buy a subscription.
One of our local cartoonists, Robin Constabaris, used to be published in a local alternative paper, and her other paper that she was published was in Salt Lake City. So how's that for disconnect?
If you're going to be in the alternate comics thing in Canada, maybe it's different now with the internet, but if you're going to be craving some level of attention or something, man, you've got to put it aside. You've got to focus on your work. And I figure with, you know, Children of the Atom, I like the line from the Leonard Cohen song, like arrows with no target. You know, you're blasting them out there.
Yeah.
And you can sense that there could be a target out there, but just let them fly. Let it fly. And
you're in a vacuum.
Yeah, it was a little strange, because sometimes now that I'm getting a bit of attention, it's like, okay, well, this isn't so bad. But the Georgia Strait thing was, it's hard to explain. It was strange, except when I would advertise the comic around Christmas time, I'd make a little mini comic collecting up the Chilled in the Atom, and I'd have about a millimeter of text beneath the comic strip. I mean, I would get 50, 60 people ordering that mini comic, and that little ad was there for, like, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? And I had that much response, and I thought, man, that was impressive. And the people would write such lovely letters. That was, so it wasn't zero attention, and I think when I did get it, it was, very nice, very thoughtful letters. So, you know, it wasn't totally zero. It's a little bit exaggerated.
Did you know, Peter Thompson or Mark Bell while in London?
I didn't know Mark Bell well in London. He would do, I was still trying to be, I don't know. The Hood is a pretty angry comic, and very angry. And Mark's was always this weird, goopy, slappy, donut-y, corny. And you know, I looked at it and I remember thinking, God, this is well drawn, but maybe it's this guy could just sort of focus or something, you know. So I never actually knew him in London, but I knew of his comics, and then it just sort of came around that I actually got to know him later on, and we're both like, oh, well, we went to the same comic store, knew some of the same people, and, you know, could sort of relate that way. Even coming to comic jams, he used to come to the Toronto Comic Jam, and, oh, it was so great. It was so fun drawing with him, and then, I don't know if you know too much about Mark, but then, I don't know, his world or Canadian tour continues. Is he in Toronto or Montreal or Vancouver or, you know, he's here, there, and everywhere, so.
He is our very own Littlest Hobo without being a hobo.
Say what?
You know, the Littlest Hobo.
Right, yeah.
You just never know where he's going to pop up and what kind of crime he's going to solve.
Yeah, I don't know what he's up to. Except, well, I know he's in Montreal now. He's in Toronto for a while. Now he's in Montreal. And
putting together his D&Q collection.
Yeah.
Let's talk about you.
Oh, sure.
I'm just going to change topic completely. So drop in... my one thing when I'm reading it, and this, I may be the only person feeling this way, because my background is I work with, or I used to work with street kids and teenagers, and, you know, it was very confidential, everything we dealt with. And then I read this story about everyone's personal lives. How do you construct that, and how accurate is it, and what kind of permission do you work with?
Well, for one thing, I changed the names. That's number one. Number two, the release... number two is I never intended them to be a book. Mm-hmm. I changed the names, but I never intended them to be a book. And the lag time on the story, those stories are all... Say the girl with the shoe, right? There's one where a girl threw a shoe at my head. I mean, that story could be 8 years old now. The names don't link up. The appearances don't link up. And the time lag, though, these people are, 20 or 22 years old now. To make any kind of link, you would have to really work hard. Like, you would have to basically dig through that art center's history. You would have to be investigative to make the links with those kids. Mm-hmm. So my thing about putting out the personal stories is the lag time. I wouldn't have had it linked directly unless I asked the kids' permission. Let me give you an example. The Tamagotchi story was permission from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
I still changed the name, but because it was so recent and the kid was still a kid, I altered it. The other stories are much, much older. I mean, the very first story in the book with the little girls and the one pushing her to hug me, I mean, that's from 1996. Mm-hmm. Those kids are, there's no link with them to, they're clothing, the styles, photos, there's no way of linking them. So what I basically did is sort of disguise everything. And then when Conundrum approached me to print, I thought, no, there's a massive lag time here. You're not going to make the links with these kids. That was my feel. I think you'd have to really, really work hard to find out who these kids are. And I think that in the second section where I was at the other art center, I don't even mention the art center. So there's different ways of sort of hiding things so that the only way you could find out, you'd have to be an incredible sleuth to track them down. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think Colin has a question.
Sure. I was just wondering if any of the kids that are grown up now have recognized themselves in your stories, if you heard anything.
No, I mean, there's only 1,000 copies, right? And for them to pick it up and make the link, it's hard to... There's a couple of kids who have seen some of the stories, right? And one of the one was the with the dead baby squirrel. I mean, I gave a copy of that story to the guy in it, right? I gave the Tamagotchi story to that person. There's another angel story, and I gave it to that one. But the weird thing is as the kids age and you would know them, you tell them their own story. And they're like, what? What do you mean? What are you talking about? What? And, in terms of persistence of memory, it's very clear to me as an adult, but as a kid, it's just it wasn't significant to them.
Yeah.
They're not anchoring it with the significance that I attach to it. And that was, that's always been part of the perspective. And that's why when I wrote it very, very carefully based on kind of what they're saying. It's very fragile that for them it's probably broken or evaporated or smoke. But for me, it remains as tangible because I'm an adult, and they don't... It's a different way of processing.
One thing I really noticed in the art style is your own appearance within it is very nondescript. Like, it's almost like you're in there as a character, but you're so minimal as far as your visual presence, like details. Is that a specific choice?
Yeah, my... My perspective on some of the alternate comics is that, when you get autobiographical, when the story is focused on you, about you, drawing you, and everything you do, it's like, oh, for Christ's sakes, you got to expand a little bit. And in my opinion, and that's what I tried to do with the book. And I always sort of saw myself as a bit of a cipher there in a way. You do these things with these kids, you can have some level of significance, but it's like you're just a wisp. What does it really count in their lives? And when you're in Toronto with a crush of people all the time, you just don't feel so, corporeal all the time. You feel, it's more like a spirit sort of wafting through these places, and the kids come and go. So I don't see my role is as significant. It's very much as sort of background. And these peculiar little lives, these little dramas are so, pointed and tough that it's not really about me. However, I'm an important character in terms of making these places like this run because I'm dedicated. So... you know, I'm like a little, I don't know, like a little piece of the foundation in the corner. But the interesting part is all the kids. I think, something like that. I think that makes sense.
It's a book about the kids.
Yeah, it's really about the kids. And if it's about me, even putting my own thoughts, I felt sort of hesitant. But when, you know, some of the kids are like grabbing my crotch and stuff, look, I have no interest in that. That's not my thing. It's not a turn-on. But I'm going to put my voice in there to make it very clear that how peculiar this is. And look, I work at the Art Gallery of Ontario. I work at Avenue Road Art School. This never happens ever. None of these kind of stories ever happens there. What the hell is going on? And that is sometimes what's an undercurrent in the book. It's like, I'm going, Christ, this friggin' poverty and all the issues. God, what the hell, right? And these little kids are carrying these very strange things with them. And what the hell is going on? And it's very disturbing. You go home after some of these events, and it's depressing. I mean, quite frankly, it's very depressing. And part of the way I would process it was drawing these out. Drop-In was never intended as a book. That was from a bunch of mini-comics where I would process all this crap all to get out of my system and not feel so horrible. But when you get enough friggin' stories, you know, Andy was the one that spotted it in the mini-comics and said, listen, if you drop all the dream stuff and some of the other stories and just put the stories of the kids together, you know, you've got this book, and at the same time, I'm like going, oh, God, you know, this stuff is harsh. Is anybody going to want to read it? Swearing, abused, difficult kids. This is sad, but, you know, he was encouraging, and so was Joe Allman. Joe Allman's a superstar, and I trust him totally. So, and Chester Brown, of course, he kept saying, oh, these are great. These are great. So, you know, I had some people in my corner to kind of keep going on out there. And then now when I look at the book, it's still harsh, but it has the correct feel all the way throughout. You can just see the difficulties in, you know, these kids' lives and particular environments where, you know, poverty's involved. It's just tough.
But you do have a affection for the kids.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's just a peculiar thing, and I don't know where it comes from, except there's some level of compassion or empathy, and I will go further to help these kids because you just see that, I don't know, they have all these obstacles, and you figure if you're that one sort of positive thing, and I'm not trying to be egotistical about it, but in a given day, if they come there, they make a piece of art, they feel happy, you're like, look, there's one tiny check mark there, one little tiny check mark in a week or a month. Once they leave the art center, then whatever. But I can be really positive and encouraging and all that stuff, and then they go home. And then that's not my territory. So, but at the same time, you can't let them break your heart or you're useless. And some of the stories are freaking heartbreaking. And you can only let it get to you so much, and then you can't let it totally get to you. But, boy, it sure comes close sometimes.
Well, there are times where, like, you go to the Vietnamese family, like, you actually go into their home, which I found interesting, which gets your own self, I'd find, really involved within a situation.
Well, that was a really peculiar one. I mean, the one girl in there, I focus as sort of like it's on Henrietta, and I'm you know, it's not their real names, but it's actually more focused on Hien. And I had known her since she was 8. And, you know, just knowing them at the art center and coming in. But, you know, you get a certain kid, you know, like her. And, you know, when she would come in, she wouldn't look up. She wouldn't, you know, wouldn't speak. You know, just the trauma on that kid. And you kind of somehow, I had a friend who was a social worker, and they said, oh, there's always that kid. There's always going to be some kid that's kind of like your go-to person or your inspiration. And it was definitely that Hien. And that kid just came all the time. I mean, there's a lot of stories about her that aren't in there, but she was just always there, year after year. Her brothers and sisters, she had, like, you know, the three brothers, in the story, there's the four kids, and then the little baby. But she was always there. The other ones would sort of come in, come out. But she always would show up. And so knowing her, you would end up knowing the father would come by, right? Or the mom would come by. Now, the mom didn't speak English, but the dad liked to chat. I mean, he liked to chat, and it got... And this was actually, to be honest, it was a sort of a dream of mine, again, being a conservative London, Ontario person. I was always so curious about seeing what it was like in those brown brick buildings. I was always curious to see the environment the kids lived in. I mean, this is, again, I worked there for 13 years, and after, what, maybe 8 years, I finally got to see inside one of the places. And then they were just very friendly about it and, you know, very welcoming. I felt awkward as hell. And my gut instinct was, don't go in. Mm-hmm. Because it's so awkward. But I thought, God damn it, you get in there. Listen, you're gonna do things that a lot of average white folk never, ever do. You're stepping over into another world. For me to sit there, I didn't put the one story where they're having a Vietnamese New Year, and they brought out the special silver tray with mint leaves and fresh duck blood. And, you know, I remember saying to him, like, what is that? She goes, oh, duck blood. And Dad's sitting on the floor with the other Vietnamese guys. Oh, come on, Dave. It's so delicious. Dig in. I'm like, I felt like I was going to be sick. And yet what I'm getting at is you can do this in a restaurant. Yeah, I've eaten pho at the, you know, pho 88 or whatever. But, man, to actually be, I don't know, in that other place, it's hard to explain. But, I mean, that came after years and years and years of knowing the one particular kid and being, you know, sort of like the dad being friendly and that sort of thing. So it was very unusual. And that was the only family. And I still know them. I still know them today. I mean, I still talk to Ian and hear about the problems in their life just never seem to go away. Good God. So anyway, that was a peculiar situation where I actually still know that family. I still know them. It's unbelievable to me.
It's a very multicultural experience, like it sounds like, especially like their experience being, first generation and just all the background. It really, like, that must be one part of kind of what you're dealing with as far as this drop-in is not just the poverty, but also like a diverse range of what are people's interests or what their background is, and that clashing too.
Well, to be honest, I mean, I have a degree in psychology, and I thought I was going to be a psychologist. And then I started doing cartoons at the university paper, and that was it. That's where I started doing Chilton the Atom, is the University of Western Ontario Gazette paper. And once I started doing the drawing, I just, you know, that was it. And were you saying about the diversity? Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. If you were on a tangent, continue with your tangent.
Well, I was going to say, just in terms of the psychology, I think what happens is, isn't everybody, you know, to a certain degree, like a lay psychologist or a lay analyst? And the thing that interested me a lot about psychology was child psychology and social psychology. Those are the ones I found the most interesting. And, gee, guess what? You know, you drop yourself into one of the poorest neighborhoods in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, and they're kids. You're dealing with child psychology and social psychology in a very peculiar end. And that the immigrant kids, you know, whether it's language or culture and you're just trying, it's like you're on your feet all the time trying to interpret what the hell is going on here and problem solving. And one of the things we had an art teacher in OCAD allude to that makes art powerful is ambiguity. And that place was so damn ambiguous that you are trying to make it concrete even though this doesn't make sense. And there's some appeal as an artist or the psychology end or just, you know, human fascination that it just... That place always has that level of fascination. Again, I compare it to Art Gallery of Ontario or Avenue Road Art School. And the kids there, you know, they have their regular sort of problems. And it seems like more like regular, whereas these kids have some kind of fracture in them all the time. And there's a light into them that you see into them the way you don't see it with other kids. Because the other kids, I mean, they're being polite or mannered. Whereas these kids, it's more like... not feral kids. That's like very rude. They're not wild, but they retain some of that rawness that's so fascinating. As opposed to, you know, I got at Avenue Road School. You know, there's a lot of kids that go to, like, you know, private school and that. I mean, Christ, they're all so polished and polite and whatever that you never really know what that kid's about, and that's fine. I don't have to. But at Regent Park, you didn't have to know about that. You just did. It would just keep kind of happening. And It's hard to explain. It's just...
Was it difficult sometimes to know whether the kids were acting the way they did because they had an impoverished background, or if it was cultural differences?
I think it was both. I think that, I know that the parents, they're off in their jobs. I was just talking to some kids, and I was just at Regent Park today, and, they got three kids, and the dad drives a taxi. And I'm not making any comment on or judgment about whether that's a good income or not, but I would imagine it's tough. I don't know what education he's bringing from Sri Lanka. If this is a really intelligent, hardworking guy and he's stuck driving a taxi, I wonder what kind of stresses that produces in his life. Does it, positive stress, negative stress? And then trying to provide for three kids and, does the mom stay at home?
And time to spend with the family, like a taxi job is, I don't know what it's like in Toronto, but in Vancouver it's a 12-hour shift.
And the other thing that I have definitely heard, and this is... When I sound PC, it's just because I'm being protective, because, there's certain things or themes that I will pick up on because the kids will kind of reveal to me a little bit. But the remarkable thing I pick up on is the number of kids that the problem solving at home includes them being hit.
Mm.
And as a common theme, that with the kids who often have issues, I think that's a pretty common theme. To the point that sometimes when kids would get in trouble, they'd almost just sort of stare at you like, are you just going to hit me? Like, why are you reasoning with me? Why are you talking? Why don't you just smack me and we're done here? And I'm not going to hit them, obviously, but at the same time, I thought, what is with this kid? They're waiting for something. Instead of discussing, like we did in our household, they're like waiting for something. And the direct stories I've heard of... different levels of beating, whether it's the kids or the wife, there's enough of them that I'm thinking, okay, that's not common, not for everybody, but there's enough of it that is there's some significant factoring in terms of problem solving.
Or problem creating.
Yeah, I know, it's a toughie.
What other interests do you have in comics that you like to be working on? Do you have other projects on the go?
Well, I'm doing... a comic about when, like a graphic novel about when I was a kid, and a lot of it has to do, I suppose, in a way we were probably like country kids. We weren't, but just the way it was in London, Ontario at that time, there was field after field after field behind us. I mean, just all these fields or ponds or abandoned, fruit orchards, and I think it was just all farmers' field just waiting for development, but that was like our playground and unstructured time, just go and wander around and hunt for mice and frogs and I've got other subtexts and subplots that go with it, but it's when as I draw it, it's like this dreamy feel, just endless hours walking around in the field. And That's the one I'm working on. I mean, I just yesterday, 180 pages of pencil so far, en route to 300 or so. But
that's a lot of pencils.
It's a lot of pencils. Well, I'm doing the penciling first. I wanted to do penciling, then inking, and then Chester kept getting stuck for different reasons. But there's a fellow named Zach Wharton, and I convinced Chester to not do pencils and inks. When you get a flow going just with the pencils, you got that flow. When you go back and forth with a long thing, it's just, you don't get that rhythm. So I decided just to pencil the whole thing and then ink the whole thing. But again, that's 300 pages or so, and that's going to take me a while. So.
Well, Chester's own cartooning strategy is far more elaborate.
I know Chester really well. Like, I hang out with him and visit his bachelor pad. And
did you vote for him?
What's that?
Did you vote for him?
No.
We don't need to get into that.
Yeah, I didn't just go that direction, but I learned a lot about the method, knowing Chester and how he works. And he's very methodical, but it seems like once he's got things in place, he actually doesn't have to think about them that much. That being said, oh God, you know, he had done, I think, 35 pages of pencils and inks. He'd finished 35 pages of pencils and inks on his next story. And I don't know what he's calling it. He may have told me, but I forgot. But it's the prostitution stories anyway. And he just dropped those pages, 35 finished pages, Chester Brown art. And he stopped it because he read Fletcher Hanks. and he started again. And I was like, Chester, man, like, God. Anyway, any people out there who do pages or do artwork, you know, if you have 35 finished and you restart, man, oh, man. And being influenced by Fletcher Hanks.
I don't even want to know where that's going to go.
God, anyway, but now he's working away at it, and I think that he's probably got the end in sight. I'm not sure when, but he's getting the pages done. He got pretty distracted by that other stuff, so.
Well, he redrew a bunch of Louis Riel because of the shrinking heads.
Yeah, and he actually, when they were starting to re-release the Ed comics, he started redrawing that. He's going to redraw all of it. So he's methodical, but he's, you know, there's some fault factors there too. So I'm trying to take away the good part of the methodical, which is, you know, doing a lot of overlays to get things right.
Yeah.
And that is a really helpful thing, using tracing paper and stuff, you know, to sort of get things right. And also in terms of just your craft, his original art is just beautiful to look at. It's stunning. And, you know, I got some artwork from him, and so I bought it from him. And that was a real turning point for me in terms of craft. You just look at, I mean, there were some of the covers from the reprinted Ed series. And just, I mean, the line work, it's absolutely stunning. On the covers, you can't see it, but if you see the original, it's unbelievable. And I thought, well, what's he doing? It the short way or the long way? And the long way is just so beautifully done. I thought, okay, there you go. That's
how he's got to do it.
As you're looking for shortcuts, you know, if you wanted to have sort of that beauty of craft, you can't just shortcut it all the time, you know?
Hear that, Kochelka?
Well,
craft is the enemy.
Yeah, I admire him that he can just sort of crank those things out, and that in the spirit of it, that he can sort of do those pages, you know, as sort of one-offs. And for the, you know, say the 20 that I find are sort of, you know, not that interesting, man, when he hits one, it's like really a gem. It's a real beauty. So he's going on the sort of the quantity end. And when he hits that quality one, it really is charming and beautiful. But I don't know. I prefer to sort of craft things and take my time as opposed to just banging it out. So
there we go. Let's stick with that. We're at the end of our time slot.
Sure.
I've got to play another interview now. The book for folks, check out Dave Lapp, drop in from Conundrum Books. A good Canadian boy, eh?
I think so. Yeah, for sure.
There we go. Support Canadian. By Canadian?
Printed in Canada?
I think so, yeah. I think this is all very Canadian.
It's got bacon and maple syrup in the spine to hold it together.
Scratch and sniff.
Yeah. It's printed, I think so. Printed and bound in Canada by Galvin Press.
There we go. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks. Yeah, it was great.
Say hi to Chester for me.
Oh, yeah? From Colin Upton, right?
Yes. Yep.
You guys know him, or?
Yeah, Colin does.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Okay, sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And now I'm going to play the interview with Brian Sundelback, Smell of Steve Comics. Next week, hopefully, we'll be chatting with Steve Bissette. I think that'll be a fun interview. Don't you, Colin?
Steve Bissette? Cool.